So, welcome to More Podcast, Less Process, the Archives Podcast. This is your co-host, Josh Ranger. And hello, Jefferson.
Hi, Josh. I'm Jefferson.
Hi, Jefferson. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm excited for, our episode number six.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't keep track of my wheelings and dealings.
Yeah, there's been a lot of them. But I'm also excited, A, for our guest, and B, because this is our second on-location podcast. We did one at NYPL Main Branch earlier, and now we're at lovely Museum of Modern Art.
Yes, it's
Midtown
lovely.
Manhattan.
In an artless room.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, why do they have all the art facing down on the table? That's weird.
Well, actually, one of my conditions for being on the podcast when you asked me was that it be conducted in the manner of Marina Abramovich's The Artist is Present exhibition, where the four of us sit around a square table and stare at each other silently.
Yeah. And start crying spontaneously. And
there is a lot of crying in the podcast, I will say that.
And we let tourists come up and say random stuff to us.
So thanks for making that happen.
We should bring in a school group during the podcast. Yeah. That would really make it MoMA worthy. Yeah.
Oh. So that reminds me, we actually have two guests
here. Yes, we should have them introduce themselves, even though they've already started talking. Yeah. But so I will just let you introduce yourselves.
Hi, my name is Lily Pragil, and I'm the NYARC, or the New York Art Resources Consortium Coordinator and Systems Manager.
I'm Alex Thurman. I'm the Web Resources Collection Coordinator at Columbia University Libraries.
Great. So I guess it would be good maybe just to tell people about, so our topic is web archiving. Have we mentioned that yet? I don't think so. So web archiving is our putative topic for today's podcast. So maybe you can just briefly talk about sort of what your role is in that. I mean, Alex, your title obviously makes that sort of obvious. So maybe Lily, do you want to talk to us about sort of the project that...
Yeah, we're very grateful because the NYARC Consortium just received a $340,000 grant from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for the NYARC libraries to start a web archiving program collecting art research materials that are born digital or web-based. So we're psyched that we've got this grant and we can start implementing in 2014. My role in this project is as a NYARC coordinator to help facilitate some of the collection development and work that's going to be happening on the ground, but we'll also be having a web archiving coordinator in place specifically to coordinate, to be the hub for all that work. And I'm also a consultant on the project to implement a discovery layer across our print holdings, our electronic journal holdings, and our web archive collection.
Cool.
So at Columbia, I started there in 2008 as a cataloging librarian and actually, in 2004, as a cataloging librarian, in 2008, we also were lucky enough to get a grant from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. At that time, it was a one-year grant just to look into web archiving. And so I was asked by Bob Wolven, who was our principal investigator on the topic, to be the sort of main person on that investigation. And the result of that was that we got a three-year implementation grant to actually have a web resources or web archiving program at Columbia, and that grant recently ended, and we the responsibility sort of shifted to Columbia now to maintain the web archives that we started during that grant, and so we have about five or six web archive collections. Three of them are thematic collections. One is human rights. One is historic preservation, and one is New York City religious institutions. And so my main role is to continue to grow and maintain those web archives, and as well as participating in our new grant from the Mellon Foundation, which is to look into web archiving collaboration. So that we got money to hire a new full-time web archiving librarian named Anna Parici, and she's doing a good job looking at ways to collaborate with other web archiving institutions and with site owners and with scholars and with the web archiving and with libraries generally, so in terms of their collecting. So it's going pretty well.
Yeah, well, we thought these would make two great topics to talk about, because I think, you know, the Columbia one is sort of well established at this point, being one of the first ones, mm-hmm. and not that the NIARC one came out of nowhere. I know there were preliminary projects about it, but sort of at a different stage of development, obviously, than what Columbia is at.
Sure.
So I guess my first question is that, you know, web archiving is sort of, you know, relatively new as far as a collection development activity. It has lots of technological dependencies and skill requirements that might not necessarily, you know, be in place when the projects are undertaken. So as far as sort of starting web archiving anew, what have been some of the interesting challenges and what have been opportunities to overlap with existing practices, and, you know, how does it mess things up and how does it make things better?
Mm-hmm. Well, like Columbia, the NIARC group, and I should mention that consists of the libraries of the Frick Art Reference Library, the Museum of Modern Art, and the Brooklyn Museum. We were also the recipient of a planning grant from the Mellon Foundation to investigate this landscape of web archiving, to look at technologies, to look at staffing levels, and just basically how we would do it, how we would put a program in place. So we had a year-long investigation to do that, and then the implementation grant, which we just received, came out of that. And we've very much gone to school on Columbia's experiences, and Alex and I know each other and have had many conversations about metadata and workflows and along in, you know, the life cycle of web archiving. So we're very grateful to Columbia, and we hope to continue to work with them as we build our project. And and hopefully we can build in some, you know, best practices that we can share with other institutions who are just starting programs. But we still have many questions. There's still a lot of open questions, and the field is shifting very quickly. So I think in part of building this program, we just need to be very fluid in what we implement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would say also, so a lot of people who get into institutions who get into web archiving start by assuming that they need to archive their own web presence. So in other words, a university wants to archive its own website for just for general archives reasons, records management reasons, or for compliance or whatever. Our angle was a little different. The approach that we took was that it was about building collections, that increasingly there was material published on the web that wasn't being published in other formats, it wasn't available in other formats, and that if it wasn't preserved in some way, it would disappear. Particularly in the field of human rights, there's a lot of ephemeral stuff put on these websites that, you know, the organizations themselves can be ephemeral if they're you know, cracked down on by their governments or whatever. And so we felt that Columbia already had a strong traditional archival collection in human rights, because we had the papers of Human Rights Watch and of Amnesty International USA, and that it would be a natural extension of that collecting to start collecting the web presences of those organizations and others. So when you get into that, what we call thematic collections, where you're capturing external sites to your organization, there are some questions around where the boundaries are, like, and one of the things that Bob Wolven is often concerned about, and as the AUL in charge of collections at Columbia, is, you know, we can't capture the whole web. So once you start down that road, you know, how do you define the boundaries of what you'll capture and what you won't capture? And so we've tried to have that justification that it has to align with an existing collection strength of Columbia in the traditional formats. And so that's the true of the historic preservation with the Avery Library, which is a very good architectural library at Columbia, and the Burke Library, which is the theological library from the Union Theological Seminary in New York City, which is also part of the Columbia University Library System. That's part of it, is just defining, you know, what you'll capture. And then when you make that decision about, I'm going to go outside our organization and capture other people's stuff, you have to just make the decision about whether you ask for permission or not. And so we have a process to do that, and it's part of my responsibility is just getting permission from these external organizations.
Yeah, so I guess that sort of leads into the sort of robot.txt question. So this is a file that people can place on their server that basically tells crawlers not to capture their site. And I think there's a lot of different institutions take wide widely different approaches to this, both as far as capturing, but then some people will capture and then not display. And I think there's lots of different levels of permissioning there that obviously are not encountered in traditional collection development. So sort of how have you dealt with that? And especially for, you know, art ephemera.
We haven't dealt, I mean, we're still developing our policies for the program right now. I think, but we will follow Columbia's suit and, you know, on the advice of our legal counsel, ask for permissions to capture and display sites. You know, we're very much interested in terms of the NIARC group in not creating a dark archive. For us, it's very much about access. It's contemporary materials that happen to now be, that we would be collecting if they were available in a print form, but they happen to be migrating to the web. So it's not as if we want to keep this archive in a box and dark. So we really need it to be accessible by the public. That said, we do foresee that there'll probably be examples where, for example, on, you know, catalog raisonnés, for example, is one area that we're going to be collecting in, that we may strike a partnership with publishers who are creating those works and archive it and keep that dark unless there's a trigger event where we can then create it. If there was a critical event that was happening and the site was going down, we could then expose that collection. So, but robots.txt, we will, my assumption is that we will not crawl sites that have that barrier up.
I imagine that would be a pretty big issue with the human rights stuff. And we do a lot of work with Witness, and there's a lot of concern in their video capture about maintaining, you know, confidentiality if necessary and that kind of stuff. Do you run into that issue?
Well, you know, the sort of industry standard, I guess, set by the Internet Archive is because they have a general web crawl where they're basically crawling as much of the Internet as they can, they have a policy where, because, you know, that's a bit too vast a scope to actually ask for permission from site owners. So what they do instead is they observe robots.txt restrictions, and as well as having a takedown request. If someone wants to take it down, they will. But as a result, there are many cases of where robots.txt restrictions actually block important parts of the website, such as the style sheets or images. And without, if you don't capture that material, the rendering of the site it leaves a lot to be desired. It doesn't look like the original site. And so our policy at Columbia has been that because we're asking for permission to archive the site first, once we've been through that process, we feel like it's all right to override and ignore the robot's restrictions, because otherwise we can't really capture the site. And we don't want to get too much technical exchange with the people that we're sending these emails to. It, who basically, we're just sending it to the contact address on the websites, and many of those people have no, you know, technical familiarity with the website design. So rather than ask them to, you know, create an exception in their robots file for our crawler or something like that, which could be done, we generally just override the robots if we feel that they're going to impede our crawl, and frequently crawl delays are an example of things that do impede our crawl, or having, like I said, the style sheet blocked by the robust restrictions. So that difference, though, between the Internet Archive having to take an approach of respecting them, and curated collections like Columbia's or NIARC having the option to possibly ignore robust restrictions, means that we can actually, in some cases, get a fuller capture of the website than is available from the general Internet crawl from the Internet Archive. And in that way, we're adding value to, you know, not just are we able to control how often we capture the site and exactly what parts of the site we want to capture, but we're also adding to the sort of general store of Internet captures, or also sometimes called mementos, in a fuller way than is available from the general Wayback crawl. So I think that's a useful thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that became a concern in England recently when the Conservative Party took down their 10 years worth of speeches, and everybody thought, oh no, it's fine, they're safe, Internet Archive. But because they put that stipulation in place, they took it down and blocked it. Then the Internet Archive had to pull that back as well.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear more about some of the rendering challenges you mentioned. There's certainly a lot of aspects to dynamic websites, even beyond style sheets, and crawler traps and things that can, you know, not render well, or not even, A, not be captured, and B, even if captured, you know, has so many different dependencies that it can't be.
Yeah, it's just really, it's interesting because this I'm not a programmer, and I come from a cataloging background, so it's technical services, but it's not, you know, at that level of programming expertise. So some of it is kind of a black box to me, like, you know, why this worked and why it doesn't work. But patterns that emerge are that, for example, streaming video can't be captured by the crawler. Sometimes video is captured, or other files are captured, but they can't be rendered just because of the way the code is written or the JavaScript acts. Sometimes sites have in their coding some kind of dependency on the live server, and so even though you've archived the site, something about the code that you've archived is going to try to get to the real live site anyway, and it's going to call what they call live site leakage, so that unless you display the site in a constrained proxy environment where you're only allowed to see where the entire universe is archivit.org, you're going to get this bleeding in from the live web. But with all these technical things, it's a moving target. For this new grant, for example, we're trying to establish best practices for site owners as to how to make their own sites archivable. But the technology's changed so quickly that if we were to say, if you use this, and this, it'll work, you know, it might seem kind of quaint or whatever, because we're asking them to use 20th century programs to create their websites. So we kind of just have to, like, roll with it. And also the Archivit, which is the tool we use, and as well as NIARC, is constantly evolving. And so even though there are drawbacks and things that don't get captured successfully, you never know whether that might be fixed a few months down the road. Mm-hmm. And many things are.
So. Yeah, as Alex said, we're also using Archivit. And one thing that we built into our grant was acknowledging that, you know, we are a little bit behind on the technology and abilities to capture current technology, and Archivit is continuously improving their Heritrix crawler. But we also felt the need to contract with a proprietary web archiving service called Hanzo Archives that we'll be able to call upon to archive sites on demand if we find that the capture we're getting through Archivit isn't adequate. Or there are limitations there, and they can't adequately capture what we need, that we can then call on Hanzo to do that capture for us. And we're working with Hanzo and Internet Archive to have a handshake where they can transfer those work files that we capture through Hanzo and put them into our Archivit collection so that they can be rendered through the Wayback Machine, so that we don't have two different silos of web archive collections.
Yeah, that sounds like a consolidation.
Yeah, exactly.
Challenge.
Yes, that will be a challenge. And we need to see how that plays out, like, whether we can actually do that.
Donate or put works into your Archivit account, regardless of whether they're captured by Heritrix or not?
We can't. I think Archivit knows that it's an established priority. Like, it's something that some of their partners will definitely want to do, mm-hmm. If they're not doing it already, and so they're, I think, committed to making that possible, but it's not quite in place yet. And so we're all very eager to see what happens with this with NIARC and Hanzo, because, like, returning to your question about the rendering stuff, that is, for example, in our Avery Historic Preservation Collection, which is about 100 sites that deal with questions of historic preservation and also urban planning, mostly in and around New York City. So one of the sort of subsets of that collection is related to the fact that there's been a lot of development of new and kind of architecturally exciting parks in New York City in the past 10 years. And many of those websites, of the conservancies of those parks, exist primarily to sort of raise money for the park, and they want to sort of look nice. And they feature these visual, like, they frequently feature full-page photographs that rotate in a slideshow or something like that, and sometimes they're dependent on Flash, which is not archived well. And so a lot of the impact of these websites is not so much the documents that are there, but the sort of visuals. And if you can't capture the visuals and render it successfully, then you pretty much failed. And so that was an area where I was finding the archive captures weren't there yet, so if this thing with NIARC and Hanzo, once they open the door for us, I think we're going to go through there and try to get some help as well with fully capturing sites that have such a visual emphasis.
Mm-hmm. And that's really important, obviously, for our collections. One example that I think is a challenge is inventing abstractions. If you've seen that on the MoMA.org site, that's a dynamic visualization where if you hover over a node, the visualization shifts. And I think that's even a challenge for Hanzo at this point that has proprietary capture software. But that's sort of the types of sites that we're envisioning needing to go beyond the archive at service to fully capture and render.
Yeah, so I mean, Colombia's been lucky in that because of the size of it and these Mellon grants we've had. We've been able to join the International Internet Preservation Consortium, which is a group mostly of national libraries, as well as the Library of Congress and the Internet Archive and California Digital Library, that sort of set standards for web archiving internationally. And in going to their meetings, they've been talking. Seen a lot of presentations recently about this notion that right now we're sort of perfectly equipped to capture websites from 2001, but
this golden age of the web,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
but since then, the shift from websites that are primarily based on HTML to websites that are primarily based on JavaScript or other scripting technologies has really made it more challenging, because when you look at a website nowadays, what you're seeing, a lot of it is actually being performed by your browser as opposed to being, captured. It's not just a bunch of links that you capture, but it's actually a program which is happening in your browser, and some elements of that, of the JavaScript, can be captured by the crawler and some can't. And so the Internet web archiving community is looking for ways to close this gap and capture newer content. And one of the more exciting things that has come up, and it was actually mentioned at the Archivit Partners meeting this year, is in the past it's been referred to as something like a headless browser, and Archivit calls it Ghost, and promises to incorporate it into their 5.0, which is coming out next year. But the idea is that you're kind of not relying solely on sending a crawler to a website server and following links around, but you're also capturing what a user of the site sees as they click around. And so that's the sort of headless in the sense that there's this kind of proxy user of the site who's like navigating it and seeing things. So I'm not sure exactly the technical details, but hopefully when this is in place, I would be able to literally click on parts of a site that I want to make sure they're captured, and the crawler will sort of follow me through the site, and that would be really exciting.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's similar to what the Hanzo has in terms of this pixel by they have a tool that goes across a screen pixel by pixel to basically trigger any dynamic response that's going to happen and capture that when it happens. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that it would follow you as you move through a site.
I hope that's true.
I mean, the NSA is doing it already. So.
Along these same lines, is there any kind of thoughts or concern here with things that are like a little more that are reliant on other ephemeral kind of stuff? Like the ephemeral input is not just like on the website or in your browser, but it's pulling from a database somewhere. And I know some artworks that pulled from old personal ads. And that database of personal ads is gone now, so that website can no longer pull them. Or if you think about like the Arcade Fire videos that they've released, their last two videos that were online, like that were kind of personal interaction, kind of choose how you did something or pulled something from your geolocation or something.
That's all under the rubric of things that scare us. But
yeah, problems.
That just brings to mind this, the idea that. The archival object is so fluid because we, all of us could go back to our respective desk and go to the same URL, and depending on, we might see different things. We might be served different things, different ads, different versions of the site based on where we're located and what we've told our like corporate masters what we like and so. just the whole thing is you can't hope to capture everybody's view of that resource. You can try to capture a few as a sample for the future, that they can see sort of what it was like to see this Facebook page or whatever. But that's challenging stuff.
I'm sort of comforted by this idea of the archival sliver. So rather than, I mean, there's going to be no way we can be comprehensive in either of our domains. You know, domain of art, research materials, we have five different categories where we're hoping to capture, contemporary art websites, our own institutional websites, auction catalogs that are born digital now, things that we have cataloged, deemed websites we've deemed important enough to catalog that we'll also go back and now capture those. And there's one more that I always forget.
Social media.
Catalog raisonnés. No, we're not. We're actually not doing social media, which is kind of a relief.
Oh, yeah.
But I know Archive, it's making a lot of strides in being able to capture social media, but that's not on our radar yet. I'm sure it will be at some point. But even within those five areas, we know that we're going to just be able to capture a sliver of what's out there. And that's comforting, I think, going in, knowing that, you know, whatever we capture is going to be better than doing nothing. So that's kind of, I mean, it's an overwhelming task to think about heading down this path of web archiving, but I think that's sort of our perspective, is that we can't do nothing, and something is better than nothing.
Yeah. I was interested, you mentioned that institutional collections, or websites, I guess, are included in that, because as Alex mentioned earlier, sort of that's how a lot of people start, or at least that's how they envision their program will operate once they start it. And I think that's true in a lot of cases. And so I guess the transition from sort of archiving your own institutional presence to making it thematic or event driven seems like an interesting transition that I assume that we will see sort of in the future. So how has it gone with, is Columbia doing any institutional?
Yeah, and it's
archiving their site.
You know, I sort of introduced that idea of institutional archiving as if it was
gateway drug.
As if it was like this sort of archiving light or whatever. But it can be, you know, if you have a big organization, it can be very complicated. And if it's done right, there would be, you know, records management protocols in place, and you would know, you know, you'd be doing elaborate selection of what you need to save and what you don't. So, answer your question is yes, we are archiving the Columbia domain, but because it wasn't our main rationale for getting involved with web archiving, we haven't gone that far in terms of being highly selective with the elements of the Columbia domain that we want to capture. So we've taken the approach of setting our seed URL as www.columbia.edu, and then adding a scoping expression which says if you encounter any other URL from another Columbia EDU host, go and get it. And so it's basically as broad as possible. And we've also gone out and looked for other Columbia affiliated institutions and departments that might have websites with, you know, so-called vanity URLs that don't include Columbia EDU in the string, and added those to the mix. Then we'd run a test crawl and see what happens. And sometimes what happens is, you know, the crawl crashes because we've found some computer sciences faculty members, backup drive with many gigabytes of data, and we learned to block that particular host from future crawls and things like that. But so I think it still makes sense from a capture perspective to just do it broadly and just get what you get, and then because you never know exactly what's going to be important in the future. But from the access point of view, that's not, you know, you don't want to force everyone to always go to the front door, you know, and then navigate all the way down to whatever it is they're interested in. So we'll probably work in the future to be more granular in our access to archive parts. And you know, even with quality control, we might say, because we do have a quality control process where we ask a staff person to actually look at each capture, even when we're regular recapturing a site over time, to make sure that it's still working. But we might have the resources to have them look at every page of the Columbia domain. So we might identify like departmental websites as having a certain priority, or student publications as having a priority, and only look at those in the quality process.
Yeah, are there any sort of emerging tools or technologies for automating or scaling up this QC process? Because, I mean, I certainly hear it's a large part of staff and therefore resource commitments mm-hmm. to web archiving becomes a lot of QC work.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I hope that's on the horizon. I know, I think that there's a lot of hope that it will become more automated. I know the British Library has, they don't use Archivit, they use a web curator tool, and they've developed a lot of in-house QA mm-hmm. automation routines
right.
that they've put into place. And so I'm hoping that, you know, we can learn from them, and they're very generous with their work with the community. And Archivit, I know, is working on this as well mm-hmm. in terms of speeding up that process, because it is very labor intensive.
Right. So one of the interesting aspects of our current Mellon grant on collaboration and web archiving is that we have, so Mellon gave us a couple hundred thousand dollars that we in turn are supposed to subgrant out to other institutions that are willing to create new tools related to the processes of web archiving, whether it's harvesting or display or access or QA or whatever. So I won't get into details yet, because we haven't officially granted these awards yet. But there is definitely some work in that area of automating QA, and so it looks good. But just for the record, so we've received our first round of submissions. We've evaluated them and asked a subset of those for a full proposal, and we hope to get that in January. And then when we've had the full proposals, we will definitely do some publicity about which projects we've chosen to fund, and what benefits we see from those projects.
Yeah, so I guess what would you, just speculating wildly, what do you see as the area that needs the most technological work or further development? Just out of curiosity, and this doesn't have to speak mm-hmm. to any particular project mm-hmm. or piece of software, but what needs the most attention, sort of both from the development community, but also from the standards and practices community?
This is
your chance to be provocative.
There's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot. At Columbia, we recently did a local portal to one of our collections. The Human Rights Web Archive now has its own portal, which I encourage you to go to. It's hrwa.cul.columbia.edu. And part of that task was actually indexing all the information inside the work files, which are very large amounts of data. I think I'm right in saying that the current state of full text indexing of web archives is poor, just because the source material is so heterogeneous. There's no way, for example, that you can, because websites are designed differently, you can't tell from looking, the crawler can't tell from looking at the HTML, or the indexer, Solr can't tell necessarily what part of a website it's coming from. So where that matters is, for example, in the Human Rights Collection, if someone does a search for, a full text search for, say, women's rights, the idea is that you'll get back all the pages that say that have that phrase on them. But if you imagine that many of our human rights organizations have that as one of several of their focuses, they might have on the top of their web page a navigation bar that has the name of their main, has each of their main issues mentioned. So one of them might be women's rights in a little box on the top of the page. Conceivably, every single page of that website has that navigation bar on it, so every single page of that website has the phrase women's rights on it.
Right.
And so when you do a full text search of that, you get, as a return, every page of almost all these websites. And so being able to filter through all that and pull out the important PDFs about, specific reports about women's rights, or, the more relevant content is a challenge. That's one thing that I hope that some of our applicants for the grants will look into, and that's definitely an area where any progress is welcome.
Yeah, it's almost like it needs a relevancy ranking, sort of.
Yeah.
And then Solr doesn't really know how to do that, given what has been given to it.
Yeah.
I would also say discovery is a huge issue. In terms of the way that, we want to build something that researchers can use, and the usability, and the way that um, how we how result sets are brought back, as Alex was just saying, for sites that have been captured over time, so multiple versions of sites over time, is really challenging. Perhaps visualization can help us in this area. I know that Archive is also working on a new front end or user interface for their Wayback Machine, so that may be improving as well. But metadata generation is also a huge topic that I think we need to be working on as well for the discoverability. And maybe schema.org can help if it's more widely adopted with identifying those areas of content on a page. But how we repurpose metadata that's created and archive it, maybe adding it to WorldCat into our local catalogs so that these collections aren't siloed and that they can be more easily discovered along with our other collections.
Yeah, I would say the automated metadata, like I think the first email I got from Lee a couple years ago where she's said, how do we get automated metadata? So it's the biggest challenge. I mean, imagine, so within the Human Rights Collection, we've been crawling since 2008, and we now have, I think, about six, in that collection, maybe 3 or 4 terabytes of stuff. And you can get a report in Archibit that gives you a file type breakdown. So within that, we can say, okay, we've got 233,000 PDFs. Obviously, manual cataloging of that is impossible. So if there were a way to, have some kind of OCR or whatever that like goes in there and pulls out key concepts and just sort of provides an automated characterization of the subject content of these individual documents, that would be very helpful. And because just no one has the time to apply document level manual cataloging to, the scale.
And this is something we're really grappling with because our libraries have a history of doing item level cataloging. An auction catalog comes across our desk, we catalog that, and now if we're crawling an auction house website and we're pulling in 30 publications at one time, are we going to have the resources to be able to catalog those on an item level? And is that necessary in this new environment? We're not sure. So part of our grant is to also employ a metadata specialist to come, a consultant, to help us figure out what level of description that we can apply, given resources and, usability for researchers.
Right. And what sort of metadata do you currently get automatically, or what?
Automatically?
I mean, you can. Well, I mean, Archivit pulls in some DC fields, right, out of I guess, the HTML, or I'm not sure where.
Yeah, so for our portal, we have three facets. So our portal has a faceted display. So three of them come from the work files, and those are file type, which is an important one because, for the situation I was describing before, you do your search, you get 200,000 results. But if you take this facet on the right, you can narrow it to just the 30,000 PDFs, and you're avoiding some of that HTML duplication that we talked about. So that's one. Another one is the capture date, because that's metadata that's already in the work file, just the date that this thing was captured. Unfortunately, that's kind of confusing for users. So you imagine that you've done a search, you've gotten all those documents, and on the right there's this facet that says capture date and different values of different years, so 2013, 2012, 2011, 2010. But the way our collections are set up, we're revisiting the same sites over time. So in theory, we could have captured the same document in 2008 and 2009 and 2010 and 2011 and 2012, and that could have been written in 2004. And so the meaning of that date is a questionable use to researchers. And then the third one, which is also actually pretty helpful, is domain. So you can say, of those many results I got, I just want to see the ones from hrw.org, something like that. So you can sort of see at a glance, these are the source websites from which all these documents came from, and I just want to focus on that one because I know that's a good source. And so there is some, some automated metadata, but nothing, at least for what we've done, there's nothing like about subject content or.
Right.
So I don't know if this is a stupid question or not, but what does the interaction with a web archive look like? Is it like surfing the web? Is it live like that? Or are you looking at more like a static page that you're like flipping through kind of static pages. I mean, what does this look like when people access these portals?
So generally speaking, if you look at an archived page, the first difference you'll see is that, and I think this is a benefit, not a bug, but you'll see a yellow banner at the top of the page that says, at least in the archived case, that says you're viewing an archived copy, it was captured at a certain date, by a certain organization, et cetera. You don't want people to be thinking they're seeing the live web and when they're actually seeing this archived version. So that's one thing. But then within that, in principle, you ought to be able to navigate the site as you would if it was live. You can click on the navigation bar, go to a different section on the website, click on an article, download a PDF, and even if everything goes right, replay a video. But that fails as often as it succeeds, unfortunately, because of the way the if it's streaming video, we didn't get it. If it's downloadable video, we might not have gotten it because the crawler didn't know about the six different hosts between when you clicked on it and YouTube actually played the video, so it didn't capture it, or there's rendering problems with the Wayback or whatever. So in theory, you can navigate an archived copy that looks more or less like the original one, but in practice, you might see individual elements of the page missing, and like the Archivit logo saying, "Sorry, we didn't get this."
Or no styling, no style sheets.
The style sheet, in many cases, hopefully in a well-designed website, the style sheet for hrw.org resides at hrw.org/stylesheet or whatever, and it's captured as part of the crawl. Sometimes the style sheet for hrw.org might live at google/stylesheets or whatever. And if the crawler didn't know about that, and we didn't tell it to go to Google to get the style sheet won't have been captured. And the rendering of it will be like a blank white page with a bunch of text links on it. And not satisfying to any users, not satisfying to the site owners who gave you permission to crawl their site. We're dealing with those kind of frustrations. It's an iterative process. You can actually improve the crawls. Style sheet is usually something that's remediable. But
Alex mentioned earlier test crawls, and that's key when you're setting up a site, a seed. To run a test crawl and to sort of figure out where those problems are happening so that you can adjust your crawl appropriately.
Yeah, so I guess this is like the scoping questions are in the Archivit parlance. The seed is the URL, and the scoping is sort of how you set the parameters around it.
Yeah.
How does that usually take shape when you're doing scoping?
I think that's the part that is most fun for me. It's because it's technical, but it's not pages and pages of code. It's just like figuring out the six domains that are relevant to this website. But what it does in Archivit, it takes the form of, you start with a seed URL, which is like the starting point of your crawl, and you give it instructions about what other kinds of URLs to accept that it might encounter along the way. So you can say, if you happen to encounter a URL from the following hosts, take it. So that's called a scope expansion, because you're basically saying, in addition to the seed URL, you want other domains to be included. The opposite, flip side of that is called host constraint, where you've done a test crawl of a website and you realize that a lot of the content there is not necessary for your archive copy for whatever reason it might be. And it might actually be a crawler trap in which, for example, a calendar function where there's a link that says, next day, next day, next day, and the crawler has just gotten stuck there indefinitely.
Gone crazy.
Yeah. And so if you...
You can archive the future that way, right?
Right. So if the URLs that are created by that calendar function are identifiable, like they have the... Most helpfully, if they have the directory /calendar/, then you can put that into Archivit and say, if when you're doing your crawl you encounter a URL with that directory in it, please block it because we don't want it, and it's eating away at our crawl budget, which is another sort of weird concept with Archivit, which is that we have a contract with them, we pay them money to be able to do this, and it has to be based on something tangible, and so it's based on a combination of the amount of data that we capture, but also the amount of documents that we encounter, which is defined as basically anything with a distinct URL. So many of them aren't documents, but they're just like GIFs or, you know, JavaScript files or whatever. But that is considered, you know, you do have a budget. You have a certain number of million documents that you can get during the year, and you're not supposed to go beyond that. So it does matter in a sense, you know, that you don't go down too many crawler trap holes. Otherwise, and then there's the sort of possibly apocryphal case that we heard about at first partner meeting that I went to, where someone, you know, wanted to capture their organization's you know, Twitter feed or something, and then they, you know, crawl Twitter. So, you know, they got the whole thing, and that was their budget for the year. So you try to avoid that, you know, that kind of situation. And I think that's part of the reason I like it, is because having the relatively rare situation of being a full-time web archivist, I have time to deal with that. But the interesting thing about web archiving is, because it's a relatively new thing, it's often something that gets put on an additional job responsibility that gets put on somebody who already has a full-time job as the traditional archivist or you know, or a subject specialist or something like that. And now they have to also capture these websites. And for them, you know, careful scrutiny of the desk crawl host reports, you know, however, you know, helpful is just not practical. So they could just put in a limit, say, for this seed URL, I only want to capture 20,000. And I don't care I can't control which 20,000 they are, but I just want 20,000 and then stop and move on to the next one. So there are ways to, like, you know, with scoping, that it can be as easy or as time consuming as you want it to be. And I'm making it more time consuming than it has to be, probably. But you can also limit things with regular expressions. For example, we found that a lot of websites that are built with using Drupal, for some reason, create these URLs where the same five or six directories will recur multiple times in a single URL, because it's basically I don't know the technical reason, but it's like, as the crawler is making a path through the site, instead of retrieving the distinct URL of each page, it's kind of like creating a new URL where it's sort of tacking on another directory after every time you move. And so the result are these kind of false URLs, and they really eat up your budget in a hurry. And I found in the Columbia recent test crawl that there, a lot of Columbia's websites are these Drupal sites. And so a regular expression can be a powerful thing, because it's a, you know, a little computer phrase that says, that allows you to do things like say, if any directory appears in a URL three times in whatever order, block it. And so I've been working, experimenting with that kind of stuff, and it's been fun to see all those things disappear that used to be eating up my time. But.
Yeah, well, you made an interesting point about the sort of staffing challenge. And has it been easy to sort of get people that were not necessarily web archivists, obviously weren't web archivists before? Like, is it a translatable skill from traditional librarianship and archival work? I mean, it seems like you are a good example that it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is we don't have, you know, I mean, I was called in to do it as a cataloger. And since I was hired as one of two people doing this for that 3-year implementation grant I mentioned, you know, we hired a second person at that time, and then we hired another person recently for this new grant. And so we saw a lot of applicants, it's true, there's very, very few that actually have hands-on web archiving experience already. Typically, we looked for things like, you know, digital library experience or experience with metadata or project management experience, which is particularly important for our current grant.
Yeah.
But you're hiring people right now.
Yeah, actually, we're in the final phase of hiring our web coordinator, and I'd say that those skills are exactly what we're looking for. I mean, we are finding few applicants with hands-on web archiving experience, not surprising, but we do have some. But project management, communication, metadata, familiarity with technology, web publishing platforms, that sort of thing. Those are necessary skills. So I think definitely traditional librarianship and just the mindset for discovery and archiving and understanding the mission and what we're trying to achieve here is really important.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it definitely, there's that question of, and I think there was a blog post recently by someone, I'm sorry, I don't remember their name, but it might have been actually one of the people that was on your podcast earlier, but it was to the point of, are web archives archives? Like, is archive an archivist as we understand it? Does that really apply to what we're doing with web capturing? And it can sort of go either way. Like, I mean, it's definitely different. I mean, I think part of it just comes down to there's already the debate within our archives discussions between sort of authentic fonds and artificial collections. So, you know, is the physical archives collection that you have really the records of an organization or an individual that were naturally produced, organically produced, you know, in the course of their, or is it that some person was interested in a topic and gathered a bunch of stuff about that, in which case it's supposedly an artificial collection. So obviously web archives are more like the latter. Right. They're sort of artificial collections. Maybe institutional sites are a little more like the former, but we have, you know, so we had some applicants who had a stronger archives background specifically, and it forced us to sort of consider, like, you know, exactly how you know what that brings to this position.
It's an interesting distinction there. It's something I've thought about a lot, about what is an archive, especially coming out of a digital humanities background a bit, and then getting into archiving and the use of the word archive that's, you know, spread around in that way. But it seems like in this situation, you know, it's kind of the creation makes it the archive. There was a recent story about a woman who recorded like 30 or 40 years of local television news. And that's all it is. It's, you know, 35,000 VHS tapes. Uh-huh. And that's, you know, that's not really an archive because it's just a bunch of tapes sitting in her 5 apartments. and a warehouse. But you know, at some point then that, you know, and at some point it could become an archive, but it needs to have something done to it, you know, that part, whether that's curation or description or something, which is part of what you're doing, figuring out how do we do that part of it instead of just doing this sweep of we grab this kind of thing.
Yeah, and I guess there are different approaches to creating those sort of artificial collections. So, we've talked a lot about thematic ones, but event-driven or disaster ones. Yeah. I mean, a lot have come, you know, the September 11th site, our collection, and ones about the government shutdown. I mean, I think Archivit is doing the Nelson Mandela one right now as we speak. So, it's interesting to see how those both take shape as a collection and then how they sort of get stewarded through time.
Yeah, those are exciting, and they're challenging for people that are set up the way we are. So we have this Archivit account. We have a certain budget that we've asked for based on what we expect of our existing collections and how we're going to grow them. So the idea that something just comes up and you do a whole lot of crawling, you know, it's not really that feasible. It doesn't match that well with that model. So it's really the Internet Archive themselves who excel at that, because they can just at the drop of a coin, they can just suddenly start capturing a lot of sites. Where we could be complementary, I think, maybe is that Archivit is a small institution with a group of people who are very busy. They don't necessarily aren't going to know that the news story that popped up today. They're not going to know the best 50 websites in the world, you know, to start capturing that. Whereas some, you know, like. If it relates to art, you know, NIARC might be able to supply some of those seed URLs, and for area studies, Columbia could help with that. So I think that's we'd like to help with event-based stuff, but we're not really in the position to start those kind of collections ourselves. But it definitely, you know, that kind of dynamic does affect us. So, you know, with each of the successive political revolutions in North Africa and the Middle East, you know, the question comes up, so what Syria sites do we have? You know, what did you, you know, go get some more? And so it's not exactly a, you know, minute-by-minute account of what's going down, but it's sort of broadening our coverage in those areas based on world events.
And so I guess who does nominate? So is this done by curators or, in Columbia's case, faculty, or subject specialist librarians, or archivist or
in all of the above. So the when we start a collection, It's always in consultation with a subject specialist, and that person usually, you know, somebody remains in that role throughout the life of the collection to help guide the criteria for what kind of sites go in that collection. And then they might also supply actual URLs that they want to include, or they may do a mix of that and then approving sites that I or my staff, you know, like find that sort of relate to the other ones that they nominated. And just sort of say, those look like good ones to include as well. So I think, and then we, for the human rights thing, we have a nomination form on the portal, so anyone using the site can say, what about this site, and suggest it to be included. And more importantly, or equally importantly, site owners themselves can say, you know, please include our site, and we take that as actual permission to go capture their site.
And you've gotten people contacting you about that?
Yeah, I think we haven't done enough to publicize it yet. Like I indulged myself in a little backlink analysis recently for the portal, and found that, you know, there was only like 30 or 40 other sites currently linking to it, and I would like to increase that number, but we haven't. I think the first step we'll take in that regard is, you know, we contact all these people beforehand to ask for permission. We can contact them again and say, take a look at the new portal, and if you like it, link to it on your site, or, you know, encourage others to join.
And, yeah.
And are you collecting, is it like directly related to the organizations or more broadly art, or
and more
who's
broadly
making those decisions?
And likewise, I mean, it's a group decision. I mean, we have a collection development group that will be evaluating websites. We actually have a backlog of websites that we want to collect.
Well, they're on the internet.
It's growing. So. Yeah, they're on the internet. But we have a growing list of things that we've come across that are ideal candidates for things that we'd want to collect, but we haven't initiated the program yet. But those initial seeds will be evaluated by a group, and we'll be working very hard to define our collection scope for each of those five areas that I mentioned, so that we do have good guidelines to work from for our teams. But we want to engage curators and researchers as well to make sure that it's not just, you know, a small group deciding what gets included, but to find out what we can add to fulfill the need for the community that we serve.
And how do you decide how deep to go on things? Because especially, you know, if you're just to take the example of an institution, like, is it just the institution and the related institutions, or, you know, I know you're not doing social media, mm-hmm. but, you know, then do you do social media? Do you do mentions outside of it? You know, lots of institutional archives will include, you know, oh, we were mentioned in the newspaper here, we're on this news story, and people send that in. And, mm-hmm. you know, do you extend out to that kind of thing as well?
And like student sites, I've heard this example. Yeah. So like are student-driven things part of technically the institutional collecting?
For us, we have three different institutions in terms of NIARC and three institutional websites. Doing the institutional websites had accomplished two things for us. It was getting institutional buy-in from our administration for the program that we'd also be collecting institutional websites, but we haven't committed to doing the entire domain for those institutions. So it's going to be a selective process, just because we do have a data budget. Our subscription is for 2 terabytes for the year, and in collecting those five areas, we won't be able to be comprehensive in any of them. Yeah, what sort of microsites are we collecting for each of the institutions is a question. And I think for us, because it didn't start off as an internal web archive for our institutional websites, we were really looking for external resources that we would be collecting in the print equivalent. So having scholarly content will be the driving factor for us. And all of our museums do produce that scholarly content, but we probably won't be as interested in capturing, say, you know, our visitors page, like how to get to us and that sort of thing, where we'll be focused more intensely on the scholarly content that we produce.
Yeah. And also, so to your question, like there are definitely things, if you imagine blogs, where at least half of the meaning is the list of links, you know, the other blogs that are connected, that are listed nearby, like the sort of circle of related bloggers or whatever. If you just capture, you know, the posts on this blog and you have all these links, but you didn't capture any of the content on the other side of those links, it seems kind of flat. And so I think the Harvard Web Archive actually has a specific collection of women's blogs, and I think they did, you know, scope it to go like a couple of steps beyond the original domain in order to capture some of that. And they have an interesting feature where when you look at the archive sites and you navigate around, the banner that I mentioned at the top for their, in their case, says something like, there's a question like, you know, why was this archived? Because, you know, because it's because you end up with some of these pages that aren't one of the, that aren't associated with one of your seeds. They're just something that was linked. And so when you click on that little link, it shows you like the breadcrumbs of, you know, how you got, what was the original seed that started us in this direction. And that was interesting. But we haven't done much of that, in part because we can't. Heritrix itself has a setting where you can say, I want to go three stops in or three jumps in or four jumps in or whatever, but that's not configurable in the Archivit interface for by partners. That's done on their end. So the way we do it is how I mentioned, is, you know, you can add, you specify specific external hosts that you want to allow, but you have to know about them in advance before you use, you know, so it's a time consuming thing. You can't just say go three hops out or whatever.
And I envision are using Archivit to crawl specific, to just capture a specific PDF, for example, and not even capture anything else on that domain, mm-hmm. to just that one PDF. And then I think there'll be other examples where we do want to do those maybe two hops.
And I think, else. Another example is Twitter. Like, there are people who are, like, obviously LC is archiving Twitter, but I don't know what their policy, I assume maybe Jefferson knows what their policy is with the links that are in the tweets. You know, do they?
Don't know.
Yeah, so they.
If I did, I'm probably not allowed to say.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. No, I don't know. I mean, I think it's pretty comprehensive, but I don't know that they're going outside of Twitter. I honestly, like, have no knowledge of it.
Because, I mean, because, you know, obviously the value of Twitter is almost always, it's like, it's these sort of, people are saying, look at this thing, you know, and they put the link, and that's it. And so if you.
And a lot of those are truncated too.
Yeah,
link rot. Right. We haven't even actually brought up link rot. Let's not.
Let's pretend it doesn't exist.
I think we're about at an hour or so. Is that about right? So
I don't know. Should I ask an existential question?
The last question is the existential one.
Just to leave us on a good down note. So do you ever have like any existential quandary that you're working to archive stuff that, and it's online, so it's like saved already, and it's, you know, it's there forever. So is it?
It's not saved forever. No. I mean, we all have experiences that things go away all the time.
Well, I wish they would.
Yeah. I kind of wish Google would release their, archive their cache. I mean, they've got this data.
Yeah. I mean, we've had, there are moments where, you know, you're like, why this site? Why not that site? You know, when we were initially selling this idea to the subject specialist at Columbia, there were some who weren't as enthusiastic about the notion, even though, you know, we would be saving sites in their area, because, you know, you're going to save 10 fish, you know, from in the sea, so, you know, how nice of you. You know, you do what you can, but I think that initiatives like the Memento project that improve access to all web archives, independent of knowing about their existence. So that the premise, in a nutshell, is the idea that you would change the HTTP protocol in such a way that it has a time dimension, so that in the future, hopefully in the near term, if you know about a website, you would just go to the website, and then you would like use a browser dropdown or something to say, well, what did this website look like 2-3 years ago? And you would just, and then that would query all the existing pool of web captures, and if there was one from that site from that year, it would show it to you. And so all of our work as archivists would be leveraged, but they wouldn't have to know that it took place. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's a valuable
Seamless.
Thing. So all of the individual fish that we separately rescue would have like a, you know, giant aquarium to swim in together.
A really big tank.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because when we had our investigatory phase, the planning phase for our project, we had focus groups and we brought together researchers and curators and users and librarians to talk about this issue. And a lot of people just assumed that somebody was already doing this, that the Internet Archive was capturing the entire web, that Library of Congress was capturing all of this material on our behalf, or that the publishers themselves or in the producers of the content were capturing it. So there was this real aha moment for people, and I think people got a little freaked out to understand that you know, the things that they might be citing in their research may just disappear, and we may lose that breadcrumb trail for scholarship. So I think part of what we'd like to do is also do a little outreach and let people know that we're doing this work and why it's important, and that it's not trivial, and that there's a lot of work behind it. Ideally, we'd get to that seamless state where people wouldn't have to know we're doing it. Mm-hmm. But I think right now people just assume it's happening and don't really. It took some conversations for buy-in to understand what we were trying to accomplish here. And now we've sufficiently freaked out everyone.
Yeah, I think the link rot, or the fact that they aren't being captured, has gotten a good bit more mm-hmm. media attention. The Supreme
with the
Court
UK stuff, mm-hmm. yeah. The government stuff.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Like if you go to the Internet Archive and look at their forum page, or like their comments page, where users just like post things, there's like two main themes. One is archive my site, and the other one is take down my archive site. So, so that's the tension. I mean, in Europe now, there's this move. It's called the right to forgetting. So they're having right mm-hmm. to forget laws, where, because I think it's a good idea that you don't want. It's basically in place to prevent the Facebooks and Googles of the world from owning all of our data, and yet it does have the potential to be quite problematic for digital libraries and efforts like archiving newspapers and things like that. The fact that anyone who's mentioned in any of those stories, you know, might sue, or it just could be a big mess. But, you know, hopefully if such laws are passed, that libraries and archives might get some kind of exemption.
Great. Well, thank you,
great.
Both
yes.
of you.
I could talk about web archiving forever, but we all have jobs, and we have to walk around MoMA. So.
Yes. So I hope we helped you achieve a little bit of outreach through our five
much.
Listeners.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.